Good morning, everybody, and thank you for being with us today, whether in person here in the church or joining us via the web. My son James said he'd watch in today, but James, you need to get cracking on with that thesis. You've no time to be watching me. Thanks to Reverend Spain for vacating the pulpit this morning and to allow me to ramble on for the next 15 or 20 minutes. Regular attendees will know that my presence in the pulpit is a clear sign that it's either Christmas week or the church has an anniversary of some sort to commemorate. And obviously it's not Christmas, so we have an anniversary. And apologies in advance to our visitors and guests or anybody listening in on the web. The anniversary is a bit in-house, but I hope you won't feel excluded. In 2018, we celebrated the 100th anniversary of the installation of the Wilson window. This is the main window of the church on my right here. Starting in June that year, we marked the anniversary with the republication of the sermon delivered by Reverend Saville Hicks at the 1918 dedication service, and with a series of readings and sermons that addressed different aspects of the window, including its design and manufacture, the theology behind the design, and the somewhat blemished history of the man to whom the window is dedicated, namely Thomas Wilson, who largely paid for the building of this church. Later that year, our late friend, Professor Barbara Wright, used the image of the scientist in the window as the basis for a fascinating sermon on Unitarian connections with scientific developments and discovery. Discovery is one of the five illustrated themes that rise upwards and blend together to make up the overall composition of the design of the window. The other themes are truth, inspiration, love, and work. And each theme is represented by an image of a historic figure in separate panels at the bottom of the window. At the centre is inspiration, represented by a young Jesus, and he's flanked on the left by Christopher Columbus, representing discovery, and Martin Luther, representing truth, and on the right by Florence Nightingale, representing love, and William Caxton, representing work. It is significant that of all the people that could have represented work, the design team chose someone associated with the print trade. The inclusion of these five figures and the overall design of the window provides us with a very good insight into Unitarian thinking in this part of the world 100 years ago. As you may be aware, the window is the third to be installed in this location, the other two having been lost to fires, first in 1892 and again in 1916. If we have ever had to replace this window, which of these historic figures would make it into design? An image of Jesus would, I hope, still be central. But I think there will be strong debates about which, if any, of the other four figures should be included with him. I think Caxton would be the most likely to be selected, if only because he's the least known. And to my knowledge, unlike the others, he has attracted no controversy in recent years. But although he is the least known of the people in the window, Caxton remains a very important historical figure, and there are other memorials to him apart from this one. There is a memorial tablet to Caxton in St. Margaret's Church in London that was provided by the Roxburgh Club, a prestigious group of bibliophiles who, at their annual dinner, toast the memory of Caxton as the father of the British press. There is also a memorial to him close to Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey, which was unveiled by the chairman of the Press Council in November 1954. And for some reason, I was having lunch in a pub in Edinburgh a few years ago, and I noticed a tiled panel of him, I think it was the Café Royal in Edinburgh, and he's among the collection of historic figures that adorn the walls there. Caxton is credited with bringing the printing press to Britain, and obviously by extension to Ireland. The printing press was a huge technological advance that allowed for a much faster dissemination of information and knowledge. The right to disseminate information was a key battleground in the Reformation. Access to the written word and the knowledge that flowed from reading was limited to a Latin-speaking elite. The reformers wanted a written word to be far more accessible to a far wider range of readers, and for it to be accessible to them in their own language. So the availability of the printing press was a significant weapon in the battle for people's minds. Although literacy and the cost of printing limited access to publications, the introduction of the printing press was still a huge step in the democratisation of knowledge and the development of civilisation. Of course, when the Protestant reformers eventually became established, they too tried to put the brakes on what people could read, especially if what they were trying to read was written by Protestant dissenters. The better known historical publications connected with this congregation of dissenters are records of disputes with the authorities, state and religious. Indeed, one publication was the source of a dispute that has defined our history for over 300 years. I refer, of course, to the publication of An Humble Inquiry into the Scripture Account of Jesus Christ, written by Reverend Thomas Emlyn, a minister at the Wood Street Meeting House from which this congregation descends. The Unitarian views expressed by Emlyn caused a scandal and resulted in him being hauled before the courts and sentenced to a term of imprisonment. His views would eventually lead to a split between Trinitarian and Unitarian Presbyterians. Other records available include an account of Emlyn's trial, the sermons and verse of Reverend Joseph Boys, in which he regularly clashed with the authorities in the religious authorities in St. Patrick's Cathedral, Reverend James Armstrong's history of Dublin Presbyterianism that was appended to a record of James Martineau's ordination at the Eustace Street Meeting House, and the proceedings in the courts and in the House of Lords regarding the 1844 Eustace Street case, which is one of the other meeting houses that we descend from, that resulted in the Dissenters' Chapels Act. Talk among yourselves there. All of these publications relate to major events and involve people who were prominent in church affairs. But what of the ordinary day-to-day events and the ordinary members of the church? Some information can be gleaned from minute books and registers, but one of the best sources of information is the calendar, the monthly four-page church newsletter, of which there's still a smattering down in the vestry from the late 19th century and early 20th century. Read individually, the contents appear to be unimportant, but taken collectively, they provide an interesting insight into the ordinary life of the early 20th century congregation. Our congregation hasn't been central to any events of national importance for a very long time, so any history of the congregation of recent years will have to rely on the records of ordinary day-to-day events. However, while recent history might not involve much drama, there's still an interesting story to be told. So where will a future student begin his or her research for their thesis? Let's call it St. Stephen's Green Unitarians in the early 21st century. There is an invaluable resource available. The last issue of the calendar was published in December 2004 and was replaced by a new magazine, The Auskult, in January 2005. Any of you who are extremely quick for figures, and I'm looking down at Dennis Aylmer there because he's our resident expert in figures, but anybody who's extremely quick with figures will by now have calculated that the edition, this morning's edition, is the 200th edition of The Auskult. With the exception of two or three editions, I have collected and kept a copy of every edition of the magazine since it made its first appearance. A recent requirement to search through my collection stirred up many congregational and quite a few family memories for me and made me realise, notwithstanding the improvements in technology that we have over recent years, how important the publication is for us as a community, and how useful it could be to others in years to come. The first edition arrived with a cover photo of a section of the far-off expanse of open space, dotted with the light of a fraction of the planets and stars that are beyond our Earth. On the inside page, there was a welcome to the first edition of the magazine by Reverend Bill Darlison, followed by a note from Dermot Hart to explain the meaning of the Irish word uscult. Dermot also provided an example of the word being used in the Irish language Bible at St. Mark chapter 7, verses 33 to 36. The eclectic mix of contents included two book reviews by Paul Murray, a report by Nuala Kelly on her trip to Venice to receive an award for a short film that she had acted in called The Carpenter and His Clumsy Wife. There were printed versions of two recent addresses, one by Gavin Hart under the title An Earth Ethic and the other by Andy Pollock under the title A Little Bit of Hope. There was an interview with our man in the West, John McDermott, and a poem, Church Going, by our dear departed friend, John Ward. Finally, there was an opinion piece by Keith Troughton under the title Badge of Faith, in which he set out the elements he would like to include in a Unitarian badge design. The second edition of the magazine also included an opinion piece under the title Badge of Faith, this time by Jennifer Flegg, who was responding to Keith's January article. The February front cover was adorned by a photograph that included yours truly, with only a few grey hairs at that stage, joining the celebrants, organisers and participants in our very first coming of age ceremony. And one of the participants is with me this morning. A study of these two editions and the 198 editions that have followed should provide our future student with ample research material. He or she will be well equipped to report that our early 21st century congregation was a lively one. That we had opinions that we were encouraged to share in the pulpit and in print. That we socialised together and got to know each other through book clubs, meditation groups and choir practice and over coffee and during cake sales and flower sales and during walks around the city and walks through the hills. That we considered the bigger questions of life and that we didn't always agree, but we could disagree without being disagreeable. That we not only had fine, too much loved and respected ministers, but that we ordained ministers who went on to provide sterling services in other cities. That the ruling body of the church was the annual general meeting of members and that each member had a voice and a vote. That we welcomed new members every October. Some of us stayed for just a short while others have become pillars of our community. That each November we remembered the young men of the congregation who lost their lives in the First World War and that at Good Friday we remembered all those who died as a result of conflict in Northern Ireland. That we suffered grief at the loss of those familiar faces that once occupied their favourite seats around the church. That we took care of the building that was put into our trust by a previous generation. That through huge collective efforts, we rose to the challenges and brought successful conclusions to the major restoration of the roof and walls, followed by the restoration of the organ, then the installation of the lift, and most recently, the restoration of the Hutton window. That the baptisms and marriages of our children were great celebrations, but they had to compete very hard with the enthusiastic build-up and celebrations that accompanied coming-of-age ceremonies. That there was an openness about our church that made the marginalised feel welcome. I'd like to think also that our student would say that we had a sense of humour and we didn't take ourselves too seriously. An item in the second edition headed On Unitarians was submitted by I don't know who, but it was a tongue-in-cheek send-up that was attributed to one of our UU critics, Garrison Keeler of Lake Wobegon days. The piece goes as follows. What is a Unitarian? He says, note. Unitarians merge with Universalists, or vice versa, unnoticed by the rest of the world then and now. Three principles underlie this merger. A Unitarian is not quite sure what a Universalist is, and a Universalist is not quite sure what a Unitarian is. And three, no one else cares much anyway. A Unitarian is a person who goes to a discussion group in order to be the first to say, what do we mean by Unitarianism? He then tells everyone what he or she means by Unitarianism, eats two brownies, drinks a cup of coffee, and goes home. Before going home, goes to the pub with Minister and others to continue the discussion, concludes happily in the knowledge that he/she is not sure what he/she now believes, and on the day of the church fair, he helps up to assist with the white elephant table. A Unitarian likes to tell people why I am a Unitarian. This is as interesting to people as how I strain my back. Because of the tremendous amount of time wasted by Unitarians of the matter of their identity, time that could be better spent knitting mittens for the fair, it seems that the Unitarian question should be settled once and for all. Here then is the definitive statement, and let's hope that we can now go on to more important matters. One, only God knows what Unitarians believe, and then only on one of his good days. A real Unitarian is very strongly anti-Trinity. He will not allow his children to read The Three Little Pigs. It is not true that Unitarians reject Jesus Christ. They would welcome him into the church and immediately put him on a committee. Unitarians accept the Ten Commandments with the provision that they can be amended at the next annual meeting. Unitarians believe that God means well. Unitarians do not worship Mary as the Mother of God, but they are glad that things worked out well for her. Unitarians are not at all clear about the concept of the Holy Ghost. They think it has something to do with a Catholic Halloween party. Unitarians enjoy Christmas pageants depicting the old story, even though they don't like the plot. A Unitarian Sunday school is a place where a child learns all about Jesus or all about the home life of a youth, depending on who's on the religious education committee. Unitarians will not be invited to Judgment Day because God doesn't want to listen to all the arguments. Finally, our future students should be able to report on the developments in opinions and changes in personnel that made up the tapestry of the life of our congregation. In the period under study, the church had two ministers, three chairmen, five treasurers, five secretaries, two caretakers, and two organists. A really diligent student, though, will notice and include commentary on something very important, and it won't be the developments or changes noticed while studying the 200 Uskalds. It will be the things that remained constant. Three features of the Uskald remain consistent since January 2005. The logo at the top of the front page hasn't changed, and the words at the bottom of the page that read, "Our bond of union is religious sympathy, not the declaration of a creed-bound faith." In the love of truth and in the spirit of Christ, we unite for the worship of God and the service of our fellows. The third feature that has remained constant during all 200 issues is the name of the editor, Paul Spain. And he was not just an editor. He contributed some excellent articles and many beautiful photographs to the pages of the magazine. What our history student won't know is that he also brought the content to the printers, collected the printed magazines, and brought them to the church and posted off copies to subscribers near and far. In the dedication of service of 1918, Saville Hicks, pointing out a panel in the window, said, "The invention of the printing press and the consequent rapid dissemination of human knowledge seem to be a worthy example of the power and value of work. It is the craftsman who has, since his day, carried and who does daily carry the thinker's thoughts to a thousand or a million other minds. It is the worker who makes possible and carries out in practical and lasting form much of the thinker's vision and the seer's dream. Not only the diffusion of knowledge and the carrying out of tremendous undertakings, not only the bridging of great gulfs and the rearing of vast temples, but the carrying out of our dearest desires for heaven on earth must depend on the will to work as well as to pray. Paul has given to this congregation an enormous amount of consistently good work that he has never sought credit or praise for. So today, on the occasion of the 200th edition of the Usculd, on behalf of everybody, I want to say thank you, Paul. Thanks for all your work. It has truly been a labour of love. Amen.